From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we consider the war on terrorism and the possibility of war with Iraq with Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Armies, and Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest. Also, writer Martha McPhee, daughter of the writer John McPhee. Her new novel, Gorgeous Lies, is a follow-up to her first novel about growing up with a stepfather who was a New Age guru. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from blues singer Alvin Youngblood Hart. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush pushed the Congress and the United Nations today to pass strong resolutions condemning Saddam Hussein and to authorize force against Iraq if necessary. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The White House sent to Capitol Hill the draft of a proposal that would give the president congressional backing for military action. A vote in Congress could come within weeks. The United Nations, however, is a tougher sell for the president's position, especially given Iraq's decision to allow UN weapons inspectors in. The president says that offer should not prevent the UN from issuing an ultimatum to Saddam.
The United Nations Security Council must show backbone, must step up, and hold this regime to account. Otherwise, the United States and some of our friends will do so.
Also at the UN, the Iraqi foreign minister declared that his country has no biological, chemical, or nuclear weapons. He also called U.S. charges against Iraq propaganda. The White House dismissed the remarks. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
A senior State Department official acknowledged today that the U.S. government was aware before the September 11th attacks that Osama bin Laden intended to harm Americans. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage told the House and Senate Intelligence Committees that U.S. intelligence didn't know what specific target bin Laden intended to attack. Armitage testified in a second day of congressional hearings intended to examine U.S. intelligence failures before the attacks and figure out how to address them. Also today, a CIA spokesman disputed a report by congressional investigators that said the CIA failed to respond aggressively to warnings of an impending terrorist attack. The federal judge presiding over the case against accused terrorist Zacharias Moussaoui has refused a request from news organizations to make public dozens of motions written by the defendant. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Judge Leonie Brinkema began sealing many of Moussaoui's motions in late August, and today she refused to change her mind. The sealed motions, she said, contain racial slurs, calls to action, attempts to communicate messages to, quote, his people, meaning, said the judge, Al-Qaeda. The exhortations to Al-Qaeda, said the judge, constitute a threat to national security, and the rest of his abusive remarks and threats about her, about his court-appointed defense lawyers, and about Jews, she said, would not be tolerated if they were in motions filed by a lawyer. A defendant representing himself, she said, has no greater rights. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost 230 points, or 2.8%, to close at 7,942 in heavy trading of about 1.5 billion shares. The Nasdaq lost 36 points, or 2.8%. It closed at 1,216. This is NPR News. What was Tropical Storm Isidore has become Hurricane Isidore. The storm is about 185 miles southeast of Havana. It has top winds of 75 miles per hour. Ed Thompson reports.
A Hurricane Hunter aircraft flew into the center of Isidore today and confirmed what forecasters had expected. The system has strengthened to become the second hurricane of the Atlantic hurricane season. The first, Gustav, dissipated in the North Atlantic earlier this month. But there are no signs Isidore will weaken anytime soon. When it moves across the western tip of Cuba tonight or early Friday, it will bring with it the possibility of 20 to 30 inches of rainfall. Cuba's official press reports the south coast of the island is already being battered by violent wave surges. A hurricane warning is in effect for western provinces of Cuba. And a tropical storm watch has now been issued for the lower Florida Keys. When Hurricane Isidore crosses the tip of Cuba and enters the Gulf of Mexico, its outer rain bands will begin to soak the Florida Keys. For NPR News, I'm Ed Thompson reporting.
Pacific Coast shipping companies are threatening to lock out union dock workers at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach tomorrow. They say members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union are staging a slowdown at Long Beach. The union, which represents more than 10,000 dock workers, has denied slowing down cargo handling at the nation's second busiest port, saying that the real problem is an increase in shipping volume and a lack of trained workers. The two sides have spent the past 5 months trying to reach a new contract that would cover 29 West Coast ports. The biggest sticking point involves the introduction of new cargo handling technology. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 26 points or 3% to close at 843. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are experts on military issues and intelligence. We've asked them to share their information and analysis relating to the war on terrorism and the Bush administration's plans to oust Saddam Hussein. Joining us from the BBC studio in London is Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest. Joining us by phone from Shropshire, England, is Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Armies. Both publications are part of Jane's Information Group, which also publishes Jane's Defense Weekly, a highly regarded source of military and intelligence news from around the world. I asked Alex Standish of Jane's Intelligence Digest if he thought a regime change in Iraq would help in the war against terrorism and the defeat of al-Qaeda.
Well, certainly my view is that since there is, to the best of my knowledge, no proven link between al-Qaeda and the Ba'ath Party regime in Iraq, I don't really see how regime change in Iraq would do very much to assist the war on terror after the 11th of September. Now, that doesn't mean that the Iraqi regime is not a danger to certainly regional security, but I'm certainly not convinced in my own mind that this will greatly assist the fight against militant Islam in general.
Charles Heyman, are you also convinced that there is not a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda?
Well, I've yet to see any evidence of a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda. And most of my contacts in the Middle East say that al-Qaeda is a much threat to the Iraqi regime, because the Iraqi regime, of course, is secular and not seen as being good Muslims by the fundamentalists, as it is to all the rest of us. So I've really, really got to be convinced that there is a linkage, a real linkage between al-Qaeda and the Iraqi regime. At the same time, we don't really know what regime change actually means. We need it spelt out. Do we mean a government which is imposed by the coalition and then is supported, obviously, in power by coalition troops? Or do we mean the Iraqis are going to choose someone? And that someone, we just don't know what his track record has been and how he'll react in the future. He may be as bad as Saddam Hussein. We just do not know. So we need to know more about regime change as well.
Do you think that you're both proceeding on the premise that there's no link between Iraq and al-Qaeda, but that does that necessarily mean that there wouldn't be a link between them in the near future, since they both perceive the United States and other Western countries as their enemy?
Well, I mean, my personal feeling there, and it is a personal feeling, is that al-Qaeda is so far away in its aims from the secular sort of government that we expect to see in Iraq, that that it's very difficult to put together any sort of answer that suggests that, that there is going to be a linkage that's dangerous to us. I mean, it is quite possible, but it doesn't look likely. It's not something that that we've really been thinking about in great detail, simply because, from my point of view, they are two sort of totally opposed organizations. The Ba'ath Party and al-Qaeda, I mean, are very, very long way apart.
So you both agree that Iraq is probably not aligned with al-Qaeda, and it's unlikely to be aligned with them in the near future. Do you think Iraq or al-Qaeda presents the greater threat right now? And do you think that focusing on the threat against Iraq weakens or strengthens our ability to go after al-Qaeda? Alex Standish?
I think the danger is that we're going to be distracted by the question of an Iraqi campaign at a time when Al-Qaeda, which represents not only a threat to the West, but to moderate Islamic regimes throughout the Middle East, is clearly, in the eyes of many Muslims, it has the upper hand. And I think that one of the dangers that we may see coming as a consequence of any attack on Iraq is that there is an upswing of both Arab nationalism and support for more militant organisations such as Al-Qaeda. I think they will perceive it not being a legitimate attack in the sense of defending the United States and its allies from terrorism, but far more in the way of America attempting to impose its will on the Middle East, primarily for its own benefit and, of course, for the benefit of its ally Israel. And I think that that is a potentially explosive combination.
Charles Heyman?
Well, I think that Al-Qaeda is the major threat at the moment. Al-Qaeda are responsible for 9/11. Now, Iraq wasn't responsible for 9/11. Iraq at the moment is basically in its box. And a campaign against Iraq at this time, I think, tends to let Al-Qaeda off the hook a bit. It takes a lot of the focus of coalition military operations away from Al-Qaeda and a lot of that focus going elsewhere. At a time when the focus really needs to be applied to Al-Qaeda, simply because that there are some really, really sound advances being made against Al-Qaeda at the moment, and that momentum has to be kept up. I think that if an enormous amount of effort is put into Iraq in the next 6 months or so, then the momentum against Al-Qaeda will drop, and that could cause us some very serious problems.
What are your best estimates of what chemical and biological weapons Iraq has now, and also how far they are in the development of a nuclear weapon? Charles Heyman, you're the editor of Jane's World Armies. What's your best estimate?
My best estimate, and I concur basically with the International Institute for Strategic Studies, is that right at this moment in time, Iraq does not have the capability of projecting a nuclear weapon. It doesn't have nuclear weapons, and it doesn't have the ability to project a nuclear weapon, obviously, I mean, against one of its neighbors. Certainly, there are probably residual stocks of biological weapons and chemical weapons left over from the previous Gulf War, and some of those stocks may have been enhanced very slightly during the last 10 years. But it's very, very difficult to use these weapons effectively in military operations. You have to have large amounts of artillery, usually, to deliver them, and you have to have huge stocks, especially of chemical weapons, to put up a really effective barrage. And I don't think at this moment in time Saddam Hussein has really got that ability, both at the chemical weapon stocks, for instance, and at the large amounts of artillery that he needs to do that. When it comes to biological weapons, they are very, very, very tricky to use, and they can rebound on you very, very easily. And you never know what the real effects of biological weapons will be. Remember that one of the main effects of a weapon system is to stop the enemy in his tracks and cause maximum casualties as quickly as possible. You can't really do that with biological weapons. It might take some considerable time for the enemy to realize they're actually under any sort of biological attack. So these are difficult weapons to use in a conventional war scenario. And certainly Saddam Hussein doesn't appear to have the ability to strike out at his neighbors. I mean, I was in the Middle East a couple of days ago, and the impression I get from everyone that no one feels themselves threatened, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Syrians, or the Turks, by Saddam Hussein. He is an obvious threat to Israel. He doesn't seem at this moment in time to be an obvious threat to his immediate neighbors.
Now, are you suggesting that if countries go in and attack Iraq, that Iraq will not use chemical or biological weapons against them because it's not really equipped to use them effectively?
Well, I mean, basically what I'm saying is that right at this moment, there may be some residual stocks of biological weapons and chemical weapons in Iraq, but they don't appear to have the delivery means to project them out hundreds of kilometers into their neighbor's territory. They may be able to use them inside their own territory against troops who have actually moved inside Iraq and in small numbers, but certainly not out into the region. There are probably somewhere between about 12 and 20 Al-Hussein missiles with a range of about 650 kilometers, able to reach Israel from western Iraq. That really, really is probably the only delivery means they have. And it's very difficult to deliver biological weapons effectively on one of these missiles, and certainly terribly difficult to deliver chemical weapons, because you need so much chemical down to create a sensible chemical barrage, and the warheads are just too small. Biological weapons, for instance, might well be destroyed on impact when the missile actually impacts. So, you know, this is a difficult one for the Iraqis. I mean, they've got to square a very difficult equation here.
Mm-hmm. And Alex Standish, is there any intelligence that you're aware of that contradicts what Charles Heyman is saying?
No, not at all. I mean, it seems very clear that, as we all know, Saddam has a track record. He did use chemical weapons against, indeed, his own Kurdish population in 1988. But there really hasn't been credible evidence that there has been a massive rebuilding of any of those facilities which were dismantled under UN inspection during the 1990s. And certainly as far as nuclear weapons are concerned, the recent report that was interpreted, let's say, as suggesting by the Bush administration that he was only 6 months away from developing a nuclear weapon, in fact, I think was rather misrepresented. In fact, what the report said was at the time of the Gulf War in 1991, he had been between 6 months and 2 years away from developing a nuclear weapon. And indeed, the recent statement by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN body, indicated quite clearly that they do not believe that Saddam has any residual nuclear capability.
My guests are Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest, and Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Armies. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest, and Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Armies. Charles Heyman, since you have to leave in a couple of minutes, I have a couple of questions very specifically about Iraq's army that I'd like to ask you about. First of all, if we do invade Iraq, what kind of army will we face? How much of the army has been rebuilt since the Gulf War?
Well, basically, the army itself has been degraded since the Gulf War. One of their great problems has been getting spare parts and replacement ammunition, things like this, for all of the armored vehicles, helicopters, all of the things that you need to run a modern army. So before the 1990-91 Gulf War, the Iraqi army was relatively powerful in the Middle Eastern context. Now, today, it has got a very, very seriously degraded capability, with many of its main battle tanks, many of its military helicopters, armored personnel carriers, artillery, all awaiting spares and not able to be used in the field. So they have a real problem. They're nowhere near as capable as they used to be.
What about Iraq's Republican Guard? During the Gulf War, there was always referred to as the elite Republican Guard, because this was the most worthy force to be contended with. What's the status of this group now?
Well, the status of the Republican Guard is higher than the normal Iraqi army. The majority of the commanders have been appointed by Saddam Hussein. The Republican Guard take a priority on what spares they are that are available. And also, of course, they're better trained. They get a priority on training areas. They get a priority on everything across the board. So there's five divisions, basically. Two of those are tank divisions and three of them are mechanized divisions. But again, they are nowhere near the readiness state and the offensive capability of a comparable NATO division. I mean, they are well down below that. And we didn't see them fighting desperately well during the 1991 Gulf War, out in the open, there is no doubt whatsoever that this is a 1960s, 1970s force. That's how it's put together, and that's the sort of equipment it's got. It would be taken apart by coalition air power and coalition armor in any battle out in the open areas.
Now, Iraq is threatening urban warfare. What would that mean, and are they capable of doing urban warfare effectively?
Well, yes, they are capable of mounting a very dangerous urban warfare campaign, especially in a city like Baghdad, for instance, where there are 7 million people spread out over a very, very wide area. There is absolutely no doubt that Saddam Hussein and his commanders will put their military assets that they want to use to try and delay or cause maximum attrition to a coalition force around places like hospitals and old folks' homes and kindergartens, and they'll make sure the television cameras are around as well. If you fight in a city, you have a much higher chance of taking casualties yourself. And, of course, you've got the problem of collateral damage to very large numbers of civilians. I mean, imagine someone fighting their way through downtown Boston. I mean, it would be absolute mayhem for everybody involved. So no modern army, and no army in history, really, has ever wanted to fight through a city. I mean, it's always, always safer and easier to try and starve people out than actually fight your way through through the building. So that's a real problem for the coalition, and Saddam Hussein knows that.
How could Iraq engage the United States in urban warfare? The United States, for the past few years, has largely done air attacks. How would the Iraqi army lure our troops into the city?
Well, I mean, they can't actually lure them in. I mean, our troops can stand on the outskirts of the city and then make a calculated decision whether it is worth going into the city or whether it's worth, for instance, surrounding the city and cutting off all the movement in and out of the city, allowing all the civilians out and searching them bit by bit, and then starving out, you know, the people who are left in the city, the soldiers and the members of Saddam Hussein's regime. I mean, that's an option. They would only go into the city if they felt that it was possible to go in and maybe get Saddam Hussein and the members of his regime that they want without massive casualties.
From your knowledge of Iraq's military, do you think there are a lot of very disenchanted, unhappy people in that military who will likely defect if we invade?
I think there are probably very, very large numbers of conscript soldiers inside the Iraqi army who want nothing to do with any war against the coalition, and they certainly don't want to fight for Saddam Hussein. They will disappear at the first opportunity. They won't necessarily defect, but if they have a chance, that they will probably go. And we would say that it's possible that, you know, 25% of the Iraqi army do not want to fight. There is another iffy bunch, is the best way to describe it, who will fight if they have to, but would rather not. There will be a small core of people inside both the Iraqi army and inside the Republican Guard who will fight. Now, the big question, and the $64,000 question here, is how many of those people will actually fight. Now, it will be a good percentage. There's no doubt about that. It's probably less than 50%, but that's probably the best sort of answer that I can give you at the moment.
From your point of view, what would it take to actually get rid of Saddam Hussein? What would it take militarily?
Militarily, if you want to get rid of Saddam Hussein, you would probably have to sit down and plan a classic conventional campaign whereby you actually attack, capture, and then occupy Iraq for some considerable time. You're probably looking, if you want to do it that way, of at least 250,000 troops. I mean, 5 to 6 U.S. divisions, probably a U.K. division, and some more if you can get them along besides. Large numbers of aircraft, and probably large numbers of ships as well, you know, to get people there and to provide aircraft and all sorts of air cover out into the theater of operations. You might have to, for instance, assault and take the port of Basra and use that as a firm base to get troops and logistic supplies in and to base your aircraft around the airfields that are adjacent to Basra. It would be a huge undertaking.
If you are wrong and Saddam Hussein actually uses chemical or biological weapons against the opposing military, how effective, for instance, are the U.S. devices, gas masks and protective suits? How effective are those against biological or chemical weapons?
Well, they're very effective. They've been tried and tested. But what they do is they slow down the tempo of military operations almost to a halt. You can defend well when you're suited up against NBC threats, but it's very, very difficult to attack and keep any momentum going once you're under any sort of attack like that. I mean, and when I was in the military, I mean, and we practiced this constantly, and we found that we found it very, very difficult to keep tanks going, keep armored personnel carriers going, things like that, and do it at the normal tempo. You could do it for a couple of hours, and that was about it. People got exhausted very, very quickly. So that's a real problem.
Just one other question about this. Do you think that the British Army considers this a fairly easy and winnable battle?
That again, is a very, very difficult one to answer. No soldier who has any experience of military operations ever thinks that there is such a thing as an easy and winnable battle. Sometimes you get lucky and there are easy, winnable battles. But always in the back of your mind, you know that the enemy is just as clever as you. He doesn't stand out in the open unless he's a complete idiot to be killed. And if you're really unlucky, you come across the guys who fight like dervishes. And there is the possibility that this will happen here. I think it may be unlikely. But, you know, military operations are the sort of activity where you really, really can't work out what the end game is going to be. But we don't know. That's the risk in military operations.
Charles Heyman is the editor of Jane's World Armies. Alex Standish, the editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest, will be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the state of Vermont, linking midweek travelers with the annual fall colors of Vermont. Online travel planner at vermontvacation.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The New Rabbi, A Congregation Searches for Its Leader by Stephen Fried. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by blues singer and guitarist Alvin Youngblood Hart. Martha McPhee talks about her new novel, Gorgeous Lies, a sequel to her novel about growing up with a stepfather who's a New Age guru. And we continue our interview with the editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest.
Jackson. Someday, dear, if I ever get back home, I won't be around here no more. No, won't be around. Oh, my mama getting old, her head is turning gray. Oh, my mama getting old, her head is turning gray. Oh, chillin', you know how that is. Don't you know that I break a heart, Lord? My living is away, yeah, my living is away.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's pick up where we left off with Alex Standish, editor of Jane's Defense Weekly, which is part of Jane's Information Group, a publisher of information on military and intelligence news and analysis from around the world. The report from the International Institute for Strategic Studies, which you've said you basically agree with, concluded that although Iraq was years away from the development of a nuclear weapon without outside help, with outside help and with the delivery of some plutonium, it could make a nuclear weapon in a matter of months.
Well, certainly, it depends what one defines as a nuclear weapon. If one is talking about a dirty bomb, that is a radiological device allied to a form of high explosives which can create localized contamination, then an undergraduate student of physics is probably quite capable of doing that anywhere in the world, given the right mix of knowledge and equipment and materials. On the other hand, if one is talking about designing a nuclear missile which can be delivered at some distance towards an enemy, then that is an entirely different state of affairs. And certainly, I think there is no evidence to suggest that Saddam is anywhere close to having such a device. We know that prior to the Gulf War in 1991, he was probably anything from 6 months to 2 years away. But one has to remember that the bulk of the materials that have been worked on, the enriched uranium and plutonium, which Saddam was then in possession of, had to be surrendered as part of the UN regime which was imposed. And so I think it most unlikely.
Do you think that weapons inspection will be able to arrive at any definitive conclusion about the status of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program?
I think they should, if they are given a similar degree of access that they were given in the past during previous inspections. Then I think they should be able to pretty much confirm that Iraq does not have a nuclear capability. I think it will be much more difficult in the area of chemical weapons, because so many chemical weapons have components or raw materials which have dual usage in other legitimate activities. And one would have to certainly say that chemical weapons are probably the area that Saddam has invested most time and interest in. And the evidence of that, of course, were the gas attacks against his own Kurdish population in 1988.
Alex Standish is my guest. He's the editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest. Jane's reports that al-Qaeda is probably stronger now than it was before September 11th. What evidence do you have of that?
Well, the evidence is in the form of the levels of support which are expressed for al-Qaeda and also for its objectives, which of course are to drive the United States and its allies out of the Middle East and to destroy the State of Israel. And one can see the evidence in the form that the Arab press, the Arab media, and indeed speaking to Arab diplomats, that there is a feeling of genuine fear and a feeling of genuine anger against the West and particularly against the United States. And certainly my concern is that will translate on the ground into support, particularly amongst young people, for solutions which one would identify as being terrorist or as being militant, I think is the word I would use.
Now, you report that, your magazine reports that ending the regime of the Taliban in Afghanistan wasn't really a major blow to al-Qaeda.
Well, I think the removing the Taliban regime from Afghanistan had two very important functions. One was that it removed effective state protection from this organisation. And the second was that it closed down the terrorist training camps, which were able to train possibly thousands of people. Now, having closed those down, and Al-Qaeda, of course, having basically scattered from Afghanistan, one can say that in the first instance, the objective was fulfilled. However, I think the problem is that the training camps that were closed down had already trained hundreds, possibly thousands of Al-Qaeda operatives. And these people were scattered around the globe, often way before the 11th of September. So although, of course, removing the Taliban was important, it certainly hasn't, in my view, had a major impact so far on Al-Qaeda's foreign activities.
Janes has basically said that the United States' color alert warning system has been overstated a bit, that the warnings have been a little overstated. What's the reason behind that skepticism?
Well, I think the obvious answer to the question is that many of the so-called credible warnings that were given have led nowhere. Now, one could argue that, of course, that's because of increased vigilance and publicity. Our concern, however, is that the whole purpose of conducting a terrorist campaign is to create terror in the population that you are targeting. And one of Al-Qaeda's objectives is to cause the maximum disruption to the US in terms of everyday life, in terms of the economy, to inflict as much damage as it possibly can. And one of the concerns I have is that people, on the one hand, will become, I think, very sceptical. The more these warnings are issued, attacks on bridges, for example, or in the run-up to 11th of September anniversary, that there may be some major attack. I think people will tend to become complacent if there are too many of these warnings issued and nothing happens. On the other hand, I think that it also has the effect of continuing to create almost a feeling of psychosis or of restrained terror amongst the population. And while I think one has to be vigilant, and I think that is entirely justified, I think one can also be alarmist. And I think there is a very fine line between the two. And I think that one has to tread very, very carefully so as not to give people within the US or its allies the impression that there are going to be enormous numbers of further terrorist attacks. The Al-Qaeda pattern tends to be to carry out one major attack within a given period of perhaps a year or 2 years, and then wait for the opportunity to carry out something quite spectacular, as we saw with the 11th of September. So I think they are waiting and they are watching and they are plotting, but that doesn't mean that there will be an incident every day.
Alex Dandish, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Alex Dandish is the editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest. He spoke to us from the BBC in London. Coming up, Martha McPhee talks about her new novel, Gorgeous Lies, about coming of age with a stepfather who's a New Age guru. This is Fresh Air. Martha McPhee and her four sisters each have a new book published this season. McPhee is the daughter of the writer John McPhee. But when she was very young, her parents divorced. Her first novel, Bright Angel Time, was the semi-autobiographical story of a girl whose divorced mother marries a former Jesuit seminarian turned Gestalt therapist and father of five named Anton. Anton has become a New Age guru, famous for his experiments in communal living. The young girl has to make the transition from a structured middle-class life to life in a new blended family of hippies. Martha McPhee's new novel is a follow-up in which the now adult children have traveled to Anton's bedside to be with him as he dies of cancer. The new novel is called Gorgeous Lies. Now, your character in Bright Angel Time, the 8-year-old narrator, writes, "This is how we blended. We had to give each other everything and not look back and not get upset. Give, give, give until our identities melted together. No privacy, no locked doors, not even while peeing. There should be nothing to hide if we loved each other. If one of us wanted to be alone, it meant something was wrong, that that person wasn't having fun." Was there pressure like that in your family to be like so open that everything was shared? You couldn't have anything for yourself. All doors had to be open. There was no privacy. That was considered selfish or individualistic?
It wasn't exactly like that. But I mean, because certainly you could shut the doors if you were peeing. But I really think that my mother and my stepfather wanted to make this family work at all costs. They wanted us to love each other like sisters and brothers. And for the most part, I'd say they succeeded. They wanted us to feel that my oldest stepbrother, Danny, was, you know, as good as a brother to me as he was to his younger siblings. And, you know, I see a lot of step-siblings that hardly know each other. It's not our case. And I cherish that. I cherish that I have these people in my life and that I, you know, they're not exactly siblings, but they're almost siblings. And it's a special relationship.
Your new novel centers around the death of the stepfather. He's on his deathbed during much of the novel, and the children are coming to visit, and they're rethinking their relationship with him. So much of the book centers around the stepfather. How do you think your stepfather, who has also passed away, would have felt knowing that he is the most autobiographical presence in this book, that in writing this novel, you fictionalized a lot, but a lot of your stepfather's essence is also the essence of the stepfather in the book?
Well, you know, when I began this novel, I had no idea that it was about him. In fact, I thought it was about a girl who was going to India. And slowly, he crept into the book and took it over. And there's a saying that, you know, the characters take over the novel and when it's really going well. And I've always resisted that because I think that that the writer should have more control. I don't like to give in to that. But it really did happen. And it is a truth that, you know, you sometimes can't really direct where your subconscious takes you. And he was in me like a seed, and he began to blossom. He drove into my life in a turquoise Cadillac when I was 4 years old, and he was an amazing, strong figure, a Texan playing poker, winning lots of money, and he'd come to our house and he'd throw it up into the air and it would flutter to the ground, and he was magical. He had big stories, and he was also a former Jesuit and a Gestalt therapist, and these words were tremendously big to me, and they were exciting because I didn't know what they meant, and I wanted to understand them. And my whole life, I've wanted to understand who this person was. And I took it on in fiction.
You mentioned that your first novel, Bright Angel Time, was told from the point of view of an 8-year-old girl because you'd read a lot about, you know, the hippie years and LSD and all that from the point of view of adults, but you were wondering what a child growing up with all of that would think. From your point of view, what are some of the things that a child would have thought or might have thought that would go really counter to what the adults would have wanted them to think?
Well, I think that I would never have said this, but the book was reviewed in the New York Times Book Review by Walter Kern, and he said, "It seems that McPhee," and I'm not quoting it directly because I don't have it in front of me, but it says, "It seems that McPhee is saying that children are basically conservative." I would never have, I didn't understand that consciously. But when he put it that way, I thought, oh, wow, they are. They like routine. I have a little daughter now. She loves routine. And we like, as children, to know when dinner is going to be on the table. I remember at my father's house, my stepmother was very traditional in that sense. You ate every night at 6 p.m., you ate meat, a vegetable, and a starch. And I loved going there because there was always plenty, and it was always, you know, it's always at 6. It would never have occurred to me that was the case, because children love to play and they love to be free. But I guess that was, in some ways, what I was saying.
Your stepfather sounds like the kind of person who would likely have some sense of what a good life was and what a good death was, and that he would have wanted a certain type of death, or at least wanted to behave in a certain way when staring death in the face, you know, kind of like embracing the continuity of life and death and so on. I'm wondering, you know, and this is a lot of the new novel takes place on his deathbed. I'm wondering if your father did have that kind of sense of the type of death he wanted, and what he was really like when he died. What?
Well, there's this expression, "We die as we live,"
mm-hmm.
And his life was, you know, he was impulsive. He loved he loved life. And he loved every aspect of it, whether it was the good or the bad. And it led him to, to go too far. Let's put it that way. But and also, as a result, it could often create a lot of chaos. I think his death was exactly the same way. He was surrounded by every single one of his children. We were there coming from California, from India, from near and far to be with him. And we were from diagnosis in June to his death in late November, there were always four or five of us there with him. And I think that is how he would have enjoyed it. I think he was scared, and I think he wished he, you know, when he was healthy, I think he would have wished that he would not have been scared in the face of death, but he was. And there was all the, you know, all the chaos of life surrounding the dying.
We've talked a lot about your stepfather. Your father is the writer John McPhee, who's famous for the detailed essays he's written in The New Yorker magazine on subjects as diverse as geology, how oranges are grown in the era of high-tech cultivation, and a portrait of Bill Bradley written when Bradley was still playing basketball. And in his writing, everything was really perfectly ordered, precisely described, factually precise. But also the essays were never about him. If he used the word I to describe himself in an essay, that was considered really radical. John McPhee used first person. He used the word I in an essay.
Wait till you read his new book.
Really?
It's fabulous, all about shad. And he loves to shad fish, so the I is very prevalent.
Uh-huh. Well, what's his opinion of you writing this kind of autobiographical fiction in which a lot of readers are going to confuse what's fiction with what's real? And he, you know, he has a surrogate figure in the story.
My father wants me to write well. That's what he cares about. That, I mean, he hopes that I have expressed myself the best way that I can. And he too, he's a writer. He's an artist. He knows what goes into the making of things, and he knows that it's different for everybody. He couldn't write autobiographically if he wanted to. And
do you think that's true, that there's just, that he's just not like, this is what you're wired to do, and it's exactly what he's not wired to do?
I think so. I mean, if I could have chosen to write about the story that I wanted to, that I set out to write with the girl going off to India, I would have loved to have done that, but I was pulled in a different direction, and that's how it happens. And he knows that he's been pulled in a very different direction, and I am very close with my father, and I call him up regularly to talk about everything from an image. I needed an image at the end of the first novel for two periods of rock of vastly different ages that come together. And I said, oh, help me, I need an image. And he said, think of a set of encyclopedias from A to Z with everything from F to T missing. And I used it. It was fabulous. And I think he wants to see me thrive. He wants to see me to succeed. When I was a little kid, he always said, don't write. He said it to all of us. Don't write. Stay away from writing. A writer doesn't choose to write. A writer has to write. And then he'd say, you know, the average annual income of a writer is $800 a year. Stay away from it. But he couldn't keep us away.
And so he doesn't feel like he is subtly being drawn into this emotional drama through your fiction, you know, a public emotional drama.
Well, I think if he thought that I was sitting down to write in order to make $1 million revealing family secrets and hanging out dirty laundry, maybe he would. But he knows that's not what I'm after. That's not what compels me to write. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested, you know, in exploring the puzzle. And he sees the intent in my work. And, you know, whether I succeed or not is a different question, but I am trying to create a piece of art. That is my aspiration, not telling my family story.
Well, Martha McPhee, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. Thanks very much.
Martha McPhee's new novel is called Gorgeous Lies. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by blues singer and guitarist Alvin Youngblood Hart. This is Fresh Air. Alvin Youngblood Hart is a 39-year-old singer and guitarist who was born in Oakland, California, and cites Jimi Hendrix and Frank Zappa as influences, but whose chosen form is the blues. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Hart's new album, Down in the Valley, shows a refreshingly original approach to the genre.
Most contemporary blues music leaves me cold. To my ears, it too often sounds like guys trying to impersonate Howlin' Wolf or B.B. King, attempting to modernize the genre by inserting rock and roll phrasing into trite material about how their baby done left them. Alvin Youngblood Hart is different. To be sure, he's a diligent student of the blues, and this album, Down in the Alley, is full of the lessons he's learned over 20 years of professionalism. He's cast aside electric guitars for acoustic ones and has pared down his lyrics to a series of eloquent whoops, moans, and pithy variations on a wide variety of miseries.
Good morning, judge, what may be my fine? Good morning, judge, what may be my fine? $50, $11.29. They rap me for murder.
Hart has a fine, scratchy voice, which, in combination with his fondness for instruments like the banjo and a disinclination to reject any music that strikes his fancy, has drawn frequent comparisons over the years to another inspired eclectic, Taj Mahal. But listen to the way Alvin Youngblood Hart sidles up to a song like Bootlegger's Blues, and you realize just how much he's his own man, with his own brand of eclecticism. You could, for example, imagine country music's Hank Williams tearing through a song like this.
Glass of whiskey on my back, and the Chevy's on my track. I'm gonna make it to the woods if I can. I take a word to go my bail, rather than go to the county jail. You better make it to the woods if you can. If you can.
It's performances like this that give Hart's music weight, so that when he does take on the blues canon, such as covering Lead Belly's Alberta, he's doing it from a position of authority, as well as unironic wit.
Whoa, Alberta! Whoa, Alberta! Baby, can't you hear me calling you? Yes, Alberta, hey!
Throughout Down in the Alley, Alvin Youngblood Hart is inviting you to share his passion for a music that has, to him, never been the stuff of a bygone era. Without imitating his inspiration for so much as a single breath, he fills the lungs of the blues, granting them renewed vigor and power.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Alvin Youngblood Hart's new CD, Down in the Alley. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Anne-Marie Baldonado. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
It was late last night, thought that I would have my peace. It was late last night, thought that I would have my peace. Say, when I woke up, Tom Hudson was shaking me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, maker of sustainably sourced hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the 25th anniversary of the punk group The Mekons with singer and guitarist John Langford. Also, Pixar animator, director, and producer John Lasseter talks about Monsters, Inc., which is just out on DVD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
There are four mirrors to draw people you want, to deflect the people you don't.